Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much. Today we have three public hearings for possible work sessions, as well as two individual work sessions. What we're going to do, because of time, I'm going to go ahead and open up the work sessions first, and then we will take the 2601 as our first public hearing, and then we will open up a dual public hearing on Senate Bills 494 and Senate Bill 768. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up the first of the work sessions, which will be Senate Bill 890. Chana?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 890 allows limited disclosure of legally privileged information without waiver of privilege if the disclosure is by the city, employee, or agent of the city to an elected auditor. If you recall, we had discussions about the City of Portland's auditor office. We have the dash one amendments. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. This measure is ready to move today, and it has no subsequent referral.
All right, thank you. So we do have a dash one that needs to be adopted, Senator Denbrough.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the dash one amendments.
Senator Denbrough moves that we adopt the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 890. And is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Denbrough.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 890 to the floor as amended, with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Denbrough moves Senate Bill 890 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And we're going to assign this to Senator Taylor. Exactly. And so we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 890. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 899. Chana?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 899, you might remember, is your Oregon receivership code. We have the dash one amendments on this measure. There is a minimal fiscal impact, but no revenue impact. It does have a subsequent referral to the General Government and Accountability, and then to the Ways and Means Committee referral.
All right. Senator Denbrough, have you had your coffee this morning?
Barely, yes.
All right. Fire away.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 899.
Senator Denbrough moves the dash one amendments for Senate Bill 899. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Denbrough?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 899 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on General Government by prior reference.
And?
And there's more?
Oh, yeah.
There's more. And then to the Ways and Means, to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Denbrough now moves Senate Bill 899 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation, with subsequent referrals to the General Government and Accountability, and then to Ways and Means. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Because that one is going to another committee, we do not need to have a carrier. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 899. We're now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2601. And Chana, if you'll go ahead and give us the overview.
Yep. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2601 is this year's reviser bill, which makes non-substantive corrective and technical changes to Oregon law.
Good morning.
We do today have a dash one amendment, which corrects the conflict with Senate Bill 302, but it is ready to move.
Okay. With Senate Bill 302?
Senate Bill 302.
All right. And that's why Mr. Mayor must be in the room here. No, it's not. Okay. Kate?
Good morning. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I'm Kate Toswell, special counsel and chief editor. This is our biannual revisers bill. The Office of Legislative Counsel drafts this in each long, odd-year session. It's a routine bill, and the goal of the revisers bill each year is to correct errors, omissions, update references, and to remove obsolete provisions. We also use the revisers bill to conform statutory language to legislative form and style. As some of you may know, the form and style is adopted by a rule of the chambers, and we use this bill to conform statutes to form and style. You'll also note that the title of the bill is relating to correction of erroneous material in Oregon law, so it's a narrow title, and our aim primarily with this bill is to make no substantive changes to the law. Each section of this bill is reviewed by an attorney with subject matter expertise in that area, so as to ensure that the corrections are accurate and that we, are making no substantive changes to the law. I'd be happy to answer any questions on the annual revisor's bill.
All right. Thank you, Kate. Questions? I'm kind of waiting to see if my newer members have any questions. Excellent.
Chair Przanski, the one thing I would note is with this bill, it is generally our aim for it to move quickly through the building and to that end so that other bills that are signed that do have substantive purpose under the last signed rule, the subsequent bill would actually control. In this case, there are a few bills that got out in front of it, and so we have a conflict amendment that is necessary to address conflicts with, I believe it's Senate Bill 302, A. Engrossed. So I would ask that that be adopted into this bill so that we address that conflict.
All right, and you were just talking about the amendment we have right now.
Yes, that is the dash one, I believe.
Right, and we don't need to do any other amendments is what I'm understanding. This is ready to go with the dash one?
This is ready to go with the dash one. As it would be A. Engrossed, it'll need to be concurred in the House, and then hopefully it will be in front of other bills that may raise other conflicts.
Okay, so that's going to take the lead, and we don't need to have an emergency clause on it. We just need to move the bill through.
Chair Przanski, members, that's correct.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for counsel? All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2601? All right. We're going to close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2601, Senator Dembrough.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2601.
Senator Dembrough moves the dash one amendments for House Bill 2601. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Dembrough?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2601 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dembrough now moves House Bill 2601 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. So in an effort of bipartisanship, we'll have Senator Manning and Senator Lithicum carry the bill to the floor. With that, we'll close the work session House Bill 2601.
Chair wouldn't mind. We've been hazed already.
Well, you never know. This will be a kumbaya moment. All right. Thank you all very much. And now we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearings for Senate Bill 494 and Senate Bill 768. Shanna?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 494 revises the Oregon Advanced Directive form and creates a 13-member Advanced Directive Rules Adoption Committee to revise sections of the Advanced Directive that relate to the instructions portion of the form. Senate Bill 768 creates the Advanced Directive Registry to store Advanced Directives should people choose to place them there.
All right, thank you. So we're going to start with a first panel that's going to be Fred Steele, Mark Mayer, and Lois Seals. Laurie, excuse me. I looked right at it and said the wrong thing. Sorry. And who is going to take the lead?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer. For those of you who don't know me, I am legislative counsel. One of the areas in which I draft is healthcare law and public health, and I am the drafter for this particular chapter that governs advance directives. Our office was called to testify today to give a simple statement as to what the bill does and to very quickly move through the bill and explain the different sections. For context, the advance directive law currently is divided into maybe two broad categories, at least insofar as you want to think about this bill. The first part of the law sets forth the advance directive form by which a person makes those decisions relating to end-of-life care in the event they become incapable. The other part of the law, which is quite a bit more extensive, is the processes by which the advance directive form is executed and other various circumstances relating to end-of-life care, those processes. So I think for purposes of this bill, though, it's important to think of it as the form and the processes. This bill concentrates on the first part of the law, concentrates on the form and the mechanism by which the actual form by which someone makes those choices. That is what this bill aims primarily to do. If you look at the very first sections of the bill, you'll notice that what they do is Section 2 creates a committee, and Section 3 assigns that committee with rulemaking power over adopting the advance directive form that will be used in the future in this state. Those are probably the two most substantively important parts of this bill, if you want to look at them. The next section of law in this bill, I think it's Section 4, it subjects the form that's adopted by this committee to special legislative oversight. Those of you who've been in the building a while know that rulemaking is subject to certain adoption processes by agencies. The legislature's intersection with those adoption processes is that they have to be submitted to our office, Legislative Council, and we have to rule on a determination as to whether or not they are in compliance with the law. This bill is different. Not only would a form adopted by this committee have to go through that process, a form adopted by this committee would not be able to take effect until after the session following the adoption of the form, the legislative session ends, and it would have to be presented to both the health care and judiciary committees unless the chair of those committees chooses to waive that requirement. So there's an additional legislative oversight over this particular rule in adopting the form. From that point forward, it's important to understand that the next section of this law sets forth the appointment for healthcare representative form that will be used. It is largely the same as the current form in statute, except it is now divorced from the advance directive form, so it can be filled out on its own. And then there's a temporary advance directive form that will sunset in 5 years that may be continued to use as a statutory form for 5 years. It is slightly different than the form that's in the book now. The two major differences is it specifically includes instructions about how a person filling out the form may include narrative concerning their narrative or other information concerning their end-of-life care decisions and that type of information. And it also allows a notary to basically finalize the form in lieu of two witnesses. So those would be the two differences to the temporary form from the existing form in statute. At that point in the bill, which I think is on page 6, it's a little bit further along, but page 9, the bill becomes largely technical. And there were certain things that our office had to do to make it work, plus there was several suggestions by the large committee as to use of alternate terminology that would be more friendly to the layperson who might be trying to read the law. For instance, the current law uses the term attorney in fact as for the person who makes the health care decisions for you. The bill changes that to health care representative, which coincidentally is the term that is in the current advance directive form. So from that point forward, page 10 forward, those are the types of changes that were being made. I could answer any questions about that material if you would like. The final thing that I want to point out, because I think it's really important to just put it on the record, is Section 32, which is the saving clauses and applicability language, excuse me, which was specifically crafted so that any type of document, even those that were only referred to in statute prior to 1993, which are called directive to physicians, any kind of document that involves end-of-life care will continue to have the effect that it had at the time that it was executed after this bill passes forward. That is what that particular section does. So changing these laws are not going to invalidate any prior executed advance directive, no matter what the form it is or no matter what law it was executed under. All of those prior advance directives, physician directives, healthcare representative appointee forms, all those things will continue to stand forward after the bill passes, if it passes. That's the end of my testimony. I could take any questions.
All right, let's go ahead and let me just make certain I've got everyone up here. I think we're going to go ahead and take questions for Mr. Mayor. And Laurie, I'm assuming you're here as the lifeline, or did you have to have some testimony as well?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Laurie Sills. I'm a staff attorney with Legislative Council's office, and I'm just here to answer ancillary questions.
Excellent, the lifeline. All right, questions for LC. Thank y'all very much for coming forward, and y'all are free to... I'm sorry?
Did we
No, we're going to do Fred next. Okay. I'm just going to let LC go back to work. I assume they have other tasks and duties they need to get to.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, we will stay here for the remainder of this particular one just in case there are questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Fred, why don't you go ahead and give us your name and your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Fred Steele. I am the state long-term care ombudsman. I am the agency director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman and have been a member of, or participant, I guess, of the informal work group working on this advanced directive form and law and some of the updates that are presented to you in Senate Bill 494. I've been a part of that for the last 2 years. Which in my role and work on that on this group actually predates my appointment as the state long-term care ombudsman. And there's 2 points in particular that I wanted to make. First, very much being in the role of my ombudsman work that we do, which is as the state long-term care ombudsman through my staff and through over 190 volunteers that are certified and trained in the state of Oregon around the state to provide advocacy to protect the resident rights of individuals living in nursing facilities, residential care facilities, assisted living, and adult foster homes. This legislation with Senate Bill 494, and again, the work in my view of the work we've done in the last 2 years on it, provides some important updates in language, primarily to provide clarity and for residents that are entering long-term care to be able to have some clarity in a form that they're trying to convey their wishes of how they want care provided to them in the future when they're unable to convey their wishes. Because of a lack of capacity, or in our dementia settings, we have 185 endorsed memory care facilities around the state for residents with dementia. There's residents with dementia and many other facilities around the state out of about 666 of those care facilities and over 1,600 adult foster homes. There are plenty of individuals that have diminished capacity or face that in the future, and the ability to convey their wishes of how they want their care provided in the future is very important. And this form with some updates will erase what I understand to be potentially about 24 years of confusion in the form, since it was put into the advance directive form was put into Oregon statute in 1993 and has not been able to be updated. So that's the first point, but and the second point that I wanted to make, and most likely more important, and quite simply what I wanted to be able to do is dispel a myth from what I've seen and heard from some that are in opposition to this legislation, and specifically tying the legislation to a case that was addressing a guardian, a resident of a care facility in an advanced directive form down in Southern Oregon. our office and myself was directly involved with that case, a very difficult family situation about end-of-life care and the care in the that was being provided in that care facility. And by the care facility and the family involvement, again, very, very difficult situation. But what the question came down to was, you know, the advance directive somewhat versus the requirements that are spelled out in administrative rule for that residential care facility and the care that they are required to provide to that individual resident. The guardian, who was also the husband of the resident, wanted to request the court to challenge whether wishes that may have been conveyed by the resident years prior before the onset, and it was an early onset of dementia, so somewhere 10 years prior, give or take, of whether those wishes could be carried out at that time, though the advance directive form didn't address those wishes, and so those wishes being not to be assisted with eating if the resident was unable to feed herself, which at that point was the situation. But as required by administrative rule, residential care facilities are required to queue and assist. So basically food on a utensil, put it in front of the face and leave it up to the resident to eat. The case played out where the court basically said that wishes not spelled out in an advance directive, you know, could not override administrative rule, that the facility had to follow the law, essentially. And that was what we expected. As the ombudsman, that's really what we wanted. Those laws exist to protect residents, and that's what we wanted to see enforced. That particular case addressed a California advance directive, and in that advance directive form only addressed artificial nutrition and hydration. That's the same as what's in the existing advance directive form in Oregon now in statute, that it only addresses artificial nutrition and hydration. And that's all that's being proposed to continue in Senate Bill 494 with the advance directive form here in Oregon going forward, is to still only address artificial nutrition and hydration. This legislation would not change the outcome of that case, would not change the outcome for that resident or any other resident with dementia or any other resident in care facilities. That the end-of-life care planning that's done is specific to artificial nutrition and hydration, and this legislation would not change that. It would not get into ordinary food and would not get into ordinary hydration situations. So, you know, with that, I guess that's really the testimony that I wanted to provide, is just to ideally provide some clarity there and be available for questions about that case that's being tied to the advance directive form. There's no connection. There's no relation between that case and this work. That case occurred about a year after this informal work group began meeting and working on the advance directive form and proposing some of the small updates that are in it. So with that, I'll conclude and ask if there are any questions.
All right, questions for Mr. Steele? Yes,
I do.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks.
Mr. Mayor, why don't you please come forward? And Laura, you may want to come up, because I think we're going to get into a couple of points here on legal issues.
Yeah, and maybe my question is for LC, but, you know, I'm not really intimately familiar with the advance directive form. But, and if a person wanted to be very specific in their advance directive with respect to feeding, being fed, you know, in a way that would override the administrative rules, and that document were, you know, legally witnessed, et cetera, would those wishes supersede the administrative rules?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dimbrough, thank you for the question. And I'll speak to that, you know, from the role as the long-term care ombudsman, and again, somebody that is charged with advocating for the rights of individuals. In any situation, if we definitively know what the rights of, you know, or what the wishes of an individual, what their values are and what their wishes were before losing capacity and the ability to convey their wishes, in the future, we would want to work with that individual, the family, and a facility to carry out those wishes. But specific to this advance directive form as I read it. And so this, you know, part of this question may be better for the legal experts and the medical experts that have been a large part of the conversation for the last 2 years, or legislative counsel on the specifics of how that would play into this, you know, those kind of wishes would be conveyed through an advance directive form. In my reading of the actual form, both in the existing form and what's being proposed for changes, those situations such, you know, beyond artificial nutrition and hydration for that end of life care, so, you know, tube feeding or intravenous fluids, that those would not, beyond that, it's not addressed in this form. And it's, I would say to some degree left void, but it's not, it's just not, it, that door wasn't opened that I see.
Okay, so if I could follow up. So there's not a kind of other section where someone could add, you know, specific desires that are not otherwise articulated in the questions of the form.
And Chair Przanski, Senator Dembrough. Okay, so yes, as ledge counsel has shown me, there are the other, the additional conditions or instructions that are in the form. And so, yeah, they could be conveyed as far as through that. But as far as the, you know, the rest of the form, you know, the specifics of the check boxes and how those exist currently and going forward, dealing with artificial nutrition and hydration, not a lot, you know, that's not a part of the form, but there is that option for the additional instructions. I would say for our role, that is something that, you know, may play out in the future, how those additional instructions would be addressed if they are in a competing stance to administrative role.
Senator Dembrough?
Yeah, just, and but I assume there are kind of implicit sideboards there, you know, particularly, I mean, the instructions can't be instructing the facility to do something that's illegal, right? I mean, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of when it veers into suicide, right?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dembrough, that would be my understanding as well, absolutely.
All right. Senator Lithicum.
And this may be more appropriate for LC. With regard to the Advance Directive Rules Committee that and the modification and changing of a form over time, can you shed more light on how that works with regard to even-numbered years, odd-numbered years that are highlighted here? And then what restraint legislative bodies like judiciary has on this. When you were giving an overview, you referenced an item like if the chair of the committee chooses to address it. And I'm curious if that's a giant loophole where the legislative body does not get their hands on it, but the committee handles everything because a single individual, i.e. a chair of a committee, says, no thanks, we choose not to review that those changes. I hope that's that's clear enough for you to provide information.
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum?
Correct.
All right. So I'll talk a little bit about the process, and then I'll talk about the second piece, which is the waiver of the requirement to have the information presented. The bill requires this committee to meet to discuss updating the advance directive form, I believe, once every 4 years. When they update the form, it has to be submitted to those committees that I discussed for an odd-yeared session, a long-yeared session, so basically 2017, 2019. And it's not until after that session commences, sine die, that the form can take effect. The waiver requirement was basically because it was discussed that, and this is the intention of the work group, I believe. I don't think they were intending to create a loophole. But the bill currently requires it to be submitted to both the Senate and the House Judiciary and Healthcare Committees, which is four committees. And I think the idea was that, without getting too complicated, that might be a bit overkill for informational on the subject matter, and if it went through one judiciary and then the other chamber was satisfied with that presentation, or vice versa with the healthcare committee. So I think it was just to give some leeway to not having the informational four times in four different committees. Did that answer your question, Senator?
It does. It describes the technical details, but it still doesn't address whether or not it is a loophole. It does appear to be a loophole.
So let me see if I can give it a little clarification. It's, you know, I guess I hear the term loophole. I mean, there is a process where a chair of a committee can or can't decide to hear a bill, but there's also a procedure that a committee can actually override the chair based on a petition to hear a bill. So there are checks and balances in the system. All right. Any other questions?
I'll defer to.
Okay. Senator Manning next.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. So what I'm trying to understand is that there already is an existing form for end-of-life choice. What this committee is proposing to do is just to update the form, but you're not going to actually initiate any actions. Is that, or am I out of the ballpark on this?
Chair Pruzanski, Senator Manning, you're in the ballpark.
Okay.
The only thing that the committee is charged or tasked with doing is to update the form itself that may be used.
So you're not going to be executing any or imposing any kind of, the form will be available to individuals to choose from. Is that if they choose?
Correct. And again, for 5 years, there will be a statutory form still on the books. So for 5 years, there's still going to be a statutory form. If this committee adopts a form before that's over, there will be a choice of forms. And then after the five-year sunset, the form that the committee adopts will be the form continuing forward as the bill is proposed. I will say this real quickly, though, because there was a lot of discussion on it. The form appointing a health care representative will remain a statutory form. It'll remain on the books as a statutory form. It is not going to be updated by this committee. And one of the choices made was, of course, to somewhat divorce it so that you could fill it out separately. It'll also always be part of an advance directive, but then the form appointing the health care representative will be something that a person could fill out individually on their own if they wanted to.
Chair Pruzanski and Senator Manning, I also just want to tack on there to maybe muddy the water a little more. If the committee says we have a new form, here's our suggestion, that will take effect if they follow the proper rules and the legislature does nothing.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And I'm going to just clarify a statement I made as a response to Senator Lithicum. It's my understanding that a committee of the majority of the committee can, in fact, have a bill come forward. If I'm wrong on that, it definitely can happen through the body itself, through the chamber, as to having a bringing a bill to the floor with the majority vote or majority. So I just want to make sure that, but I believe that can actually happen. And Mr. Mayor, I know this is not your area. Do you have any comment to what I just put on the record?
Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee, no.
It's in our rules. Yeah, I think it's in the rules. Yeah. I just want to make sure we have everything, the T's crossed, I's dotted.
I think both are options.
Yes.
Chair.
If I may follow up.
You may.
Per Chana's last comment, the form, removing it from statute is an interesting twist, and I'm curious. I'd like to know the logic or reasoning behind that. And then, what Chana just described was, if the legislature does nothing, and that's back to that kind of loophole that I was addressing a moment ago. It just happens because it happened, and there's no no, in a technical sense, there's no direct oversight from the legislative body. There's nothing in statute. The form is just changing out there. And I see the chair shaking his head, so you can comment on that as well.
Absolutely.
And then I'd appreciate your thoughts.
So let the chair start with this. The bottom line is that the process works, that it's basically this group got together, and what we wanted to do is give them the flexibility to meet and be able to review the forms every 4 years to determine whether or not they're meeting the needs of the Oregonians in having an advanced directive. We decided was that it was appropriate for them to be able to have that authority. We've given this authority to other for other I'm going to call it farm making processes. We have put in place through this work group's work requirement that it be filed and provided the report to four committees. So we have two on each side of the chambers to actually have access to it to make determinations. Any of those four committees will have the ability and the right to actually take the legislation up if they choose, or the rules, proposed rules up, to decide whether they want to make any changes. And I'll let Mr. Mayor fill in the blanks because there's one other part.
Well, let me just jump in. If I may, I'm curious about this. The do nothing statement puts the new form in place instead of the do nothing statement keeps the old form active. That's the point I'm driving at.
Right, and that is a process that has been used by this body on multiple times to basically say that if the and the administrative rules, I believe, is one of the areas that we have had this discussion before as to whether they would take an affirmative action or if they would just go into effect based on inaction by the legislature. The most important key for me is the check and balance, is the requirement that they have to actually submit any proposals, in this case not to one committee, not two committees, but four committees that have two different subject matters, legal and medical. Mr. Mayor, do you have anything else you'd like to add to that?
Chair Przanski, Senator Linthicum, the only thing I really feel qualified to talk about is the difference between the normal administrative rule process and this administrative rule process that's specially created here. I think Senator Przanski has covered it pretty well. Would you like me to further speak to that, Senator Linthicum?
No, I believe I understand the idea. The special administrative rule process is really, you know, what I'm addressing, and that's an area, something as important as advanced directive and end of life health care seems to me ought to get touched in a proactive manner versus reviewed and just sliding through because it's the way we do things.
Well, we actually do it both multiple ways, and so there's different processes. Court administrative rules is, I think, an example of one that is set up very similar to what this model has. And there we have a committee that basically that's their task, and they will make multiple changes, and then they will come before the legislature in the same path or model that this calls for. Any other questions or comments? And I do want to go through a couple of things. Mr. Steele, Fred, thank you for putting some stuff on the record, but I asked council to come up because I wanted to go through a couple of things. And let's see, the other one that we had was the definitions. So on the artificial administration, nutrition, and hydration, I'd like to just have that clarified. It's my understanding, looking at the administrative or looking at the legislative rules of how that's been defined, that's basically a technical term for using tube feeding or a tube to administer food and water. Is that correct? The artificially administered nutrition and hydration.
And Chair Przanski, if you know, from my understanding, yes, but I believe there are others coming up, legal, medical experts. It'll be better to answer that question.
Let me just put on the record here, under the current statutes, under ORS 127.505, this would be number four, artificially administered nutrition and hydration means a medical intervention to provide food and water by tube, and it goes on from there. So I just want to make certain we set a record and people understand exactly when we use technical terms what that actually means in layman's terms. All right, is there any other comment to that?
No. Essentially, 4A and 4B highlight what it does include and what it does not include, and it's a little bit circular because the term tube feeding shows up in new language. Excuse me. On the form.
You okay?
I'll take a sip.
Okay. Want water?
All right. Yeah. No, this is
okay.
Page six.
Page six.
Actually, page eight, top of page. Thanks. Page 8, top of page, tube feeding is somewhat circular. It claims to mean artificially administered food and water.
All right, so on page 8, and so where that's in the form itself is what I'm assuming.
Yes, it
which
is.
Would be actually, we'll be using the dash 2s for the form since that's basically what he does it. So we need to move across on that.
And there.
Chair Pruszanski, members of the committee,
okay.
Senator Linthicum, I believe that in the dash twos, the definition is the same. If you look at page 14 of the base bill, right above where it says technical amendments, you'll see that tube feeding has been removed from the general statutory definitional section. And the reason why is that tube feeding and life support both were terms in 1993 that they adopted specifically because they would be more understandable by lay people, lay persons. That goes all the way back to 1993. They're only used in the forms, which is why we went ahead and moved the definitions as they currently exist into the form, because we thought a layperson should also know how the term is defined. So we moved them into the form itself so that somebody was reading through the form, they could see it and see how it's defined. We did not change the definition from the existing definition. We merely moved it to where it's being used. For more additional, and probably, I don't know if we're getting too much in the weeds here, information on this, I believe if you look at I think it's the definition for life-sustaining procedure. Yeah. Life-sustaining procedure, that language, which is used throughout the series itself, where the legal language is life-sustaining procedure, it kind of tracks, although in much more technical terms, what tube feeding and life support mean. So there's an intersection between those three terms in this series. And our goal is to try to not to change those terms, but we did move the one into the form where it's actually being used.
All right. If there's not any other questions, if there are, let's have them. If not,
no. The confusion the on the form, page 7 of proposed amendments number 2, if I may, Chair. Mm-hmm. Tube feeding means artificial administered food and water. If you refuse tube feeding, and then it goes on from there,
right.
And then we define artificial administered food and water as as being a different term. It doesn't refer to, quote, tube feeding in the main body. Artificial administered nutrition and hydration means medical intervention. So we're calling it A and we're calling it B. And then I'm just curious, for confusion's sake, the explanation is fine.
The reason that the farms use more, let's say, common language is to try to make it more understandable by the individual who's making these decisions while they're competent, but still making certain they understand in their terms, or more likely in their terms, as compared to having legal or other medical type terms that may be not as familiar to the person who has the farm in front of them at the time they're filling it out. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you all very much. Our next panel is going to include Dr. Woody English, Sarah, I believe it's Kaufman or Kuffman. I'm not sure. It's an O and an F. O or U, excuse me. And then Sister Linda Thompson. If you three would come forward, please. Good morning to all. I'm not sure who would like to lead off, but whoever would like to start, if you'll give us your name first.
You want me to start? Okay. Chairman Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Woodruff English. I'm a physician practicing in Oregon since the 1970s, and I'm here to talk about the Oregon Advance Directive, which has been part of my practice the entire time that I've been here. I first came as an epidemiologist and worked with the Oregon Health Division in the 1970s, dealing with communicable diseases. And when I went into active practice as a primary care internal medicine physician and infectious disease specialist, some of my first patients in the early 1980s were individuals with HIV/AIDS. In fact, I think I was the first physician to take care of an AIDS patient in the state of Oregon. And I joined the Oregon AIDS Task Force. And for those many years in the early 1980s, I had a large population of young men, mostly a few young women, who had an illness that was chronically progressive and for which we had no treatment, and virtually 100% of them died. Later in my practice, I started a hospitalist program for Providence St. Vincent Hospital in Portland. Hospitalists are physicians who admit patients to the hospital, manage their care in consultation with specialists in the hospital, and arrange for a discharge plan, and are responsible for formulating a care plan for patients in the hospital that makes sense for them. And also will serve them well when they leave the hospital. Some of those patients do not leave the hospital. They die in the hospital. In the course of revising the care plan and talking with those patients and their families, we engage in something called a goals of care conversation, which is a discernment around what the patient's values and wishes are so that we can bring to their service the technical advances we have in medicine to meet their needs. Because of my interest in goals of care conversation, I actually shifted my practice focus. I went back to school and became board certified in palliative care and hospice, and completed my career as a palliative care physician and hospice physician, and I retired 3 years ago. My interest in the goals of care conversation and promoting advanced directives has continued, and I've worked in my retirement on a number of projects, both here locally and nationally, to promote goals of care conversations that meet the whole person's needs, be they spiritual, social, family-oriented, financial, all of the reasons why a person would have reasons to want a particular kind of medical care plan. because of my long journey here in Oregon, I've actually traced all of this going back to when Barney Speight and I'm blocking out his other name, started Oregon Health Decisions in the 1970s, and went around and did community focus groups, which eventually led to the Oregon Health Plan and to the Oregon Advanced Directives Initiative, which has placed our state in the forefront nationally in providing this kind of medical care for our citizens. And so the Power of Attorney Act and the Directives to Physicians Act, which was enacted in 1978, occurred while I was here in Oregon. And in 1993, the Oregon Health Decisions Act combined those two documents, one of which appointed basically a power of attorney, or what we now call a healthcare representative, with the wishes of a person, their directives, into one document. And since then, and it's been almost a quarter of a century, this has been our Oregon Advanced Directive. The interesting thing, and what I've observed in my practice, is that the Oregon Advanced Directive started out because people were very concerned that they might receive cardiopulmonary resuscitation and really aggressive life-prolonging care and wanted to have a say in that. What we learned is that the Advanced Directive often is not present at the time when those acts are initiated on a person, and therefore really doesn't fulfill its promise. And so, and the example of that actually came out of an individual who had end-staged, I think it was prostate cancer, and was receiving radiation treatment for the management of his pain, was living in a assisted living or a care facility, and was being transported to the radiation treatment center at the hospital in an ambulance for his treatments, and had clearly said in his advance directive that he didn't want to be resuscitated. And on one of those trips, actually had a cardiac arrest in the ambulance, and the ambulance personnel resuscitated him against what the advance directive said. This didn't make sense, and so we've come up with a remedy for that, which is the Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or PULSED. The PULSED form then came after all this advanced directive activity and initiative, and what the PULSED form does is provide a safe harbor and legal protection for EMTs and other healthcare personnel not to initiate life-prolonging care if it's not desired by the patient. And the way we've done that is to create a medical order so that that will take place in any medical setting, be it a nursing home, advanced care, assisted living facility, or an ambulance. And the PULSED initiative, which started in 1995, was when we had our first PULSED form, has become incredibly successful and is now part of a national movement for this type of order. What we have learned, and I participated in the work group that's been fomenting this legislation that's before you now, is we did a survey of attorneys, and the attorneys were attorneys who are most likely to help their clients with advanced directives. And we also surveyed primary care physicians, and we discovered that there was surprisingly a significant percentage of not just attorneys but also physicians who couldn't tell the difference between a PULSED form and an advanced directive. And that's the problem. And the problem is that the advanced directive started out addressing these issues around aggressive life support because we had nothing better. The PULSED came along, has done a much better job with that. The PULSED is incredibly effective, and I'm happy to answer your questions about that, and we'll go through this slide in just a moment. Yeah. But the advanced directive is now being superseded by the PULSED in practice in the state, and in many places where an advanced directive is needed along with a cardio a CPR or code order would be perfectly sufficient. We're finding that people are filling out Pulse, which is causing tremendous confusion and is actually inappropriate. I sit on the Oregon Pulse Task Force, or the Oregon Pulse Coalition right now, and we're having a very difficult time sorting out and getting that going. So it's important that we go back and look at our advanced directive, which was created 24 years ago and cannot be changed, and change it in ways that it's clearly differentiated from the Pulse, that we can go back with an educational initiative to our citizens and point out to them the real value of an advanced directive and how it differs from the Pulse. And I'd be happy to answer your questions to try to clarify and tease out the differences, because that's really why we're here, is to show how the advanced directive is different from the Pulse. And as you'll see, the advanced directive is a legal document. A Pulse is a medical order. The advanced directive is for all adults, regardless of health status, at any age after age 18. The Pulse is really for people who have progressive serious illness or frailty and a limited prognosis. And it's filled out depending upon your health status and the ability of the healthcare providers to prognosticate for you. What the advanced directive does is it appoints a healthcare representative, which is really important and I think is underemphasized. As we go through life, life is complicated and healthcare has become very complex and technical. And you cannot in advance solve every problem. You need somebody who can be there in real time, who can absorb a lot of complex information and help to come up with a advice and care plan. And that's what the healthcare representative does. And the real value of the advanced directive is that it provides a template for educating your healthcare representative. So the focus in the advanced directive should be at creating a healthcare representative and then mentoring and grooming and educating that person on the best way to make decisions should the situation arise, which is very different from how a lot of people think about it. It's not a prescription for this is what you have to do. It's a method for conveying your values and who you are and what's important to you to some future time when the complexity is going to require some very thoughtful discussion and back and forth.
Dr. English, I need you to wrap up. We have five more panels.
I'm sorry. Okay. So, and the Pulse is a very specific order, which I heard in your conversation you were really focused on. And so you can read the last of it. It just emphasizes that. So I'll be happy to answer any questions from my experience that would help clarify what we're about.
All right. Thank you. Who would like to go next in giving testimony?
Excuse me. Good morning, Chair Polzanski and members of the committee. My name is Sister Linda Thompson, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak about, I think, the importance and timeliness of Senate Bill 494. Excuse me. I'm a Sister of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, and I currently serve as the Director of Mission Integration at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center in Portland. I have worked in the Ministry of Catholic Health Care for over 25 years, excuse me, and appreciate its witness to patient-centered and compassionate care for families and patients at every stage of their life journey. I have had the privilege of, during these years, of sitting with families and married couples, parents and children in a variety of settings, parish halls, living rooms, hospital gathering areas, to be with them to facilitate and witness to the powerful and grace-filled conversations that all of us will hopefully someday have, how we will choose to live our later years and those final days with the greatest possible peace, comfort, and support. I have used the advanced directives, such as we have spoken of in its earlier form, as a tool to guide these conversations, to help people tell their stories, and to help families and loved ones really talk to each other about what deeply matters to them. The tool has sometimes been helpful, mostly as a guide for conversation, but it has been at times also confusing. As Catholic healthcare ministry established by the Providence system over 160 years ago, Our mission is to reveal God's love for all through compassionate service and is rooted in the arts and sciences of medicine, centuries-old Catholic tradition, and the practices of care for the dying, and especially a profound commitment to walking one another through this journey of life as a community. This mission speaks to the importance of embracing those who are suffering and honoring the dignity of every person. Every day at Providence, we commit ourselves to the practice of those caring behaviors that will nurture the spiritual, physical, and emotional well-being of those we serve. This is never more important than when patients become most vulnerable and are unable to express their wishes, and the healthcare representatives and families are faced with the impending grief and loss while struggling to make extremely difficult decisions. An earlier, effective, and meaningful conversation which results in an advanced directive to guide medical treatment based on patients' wishes is truly a godsend at this time. I have seen it so often ease the anxiety and stress. I've heard, perhaps you have as well, "Well, we know what Mom wanted." So at this time, I'm reminded that, like an iceberg, 9/10 of who we are is really below the surface, made up of those unspoken and unconscious values that do shape each of us and provide the richness of our personal story and narrative, a story we must tell each other often and be encouraged to tell more frequently. Oregon's current binary checklist, the advanced directive form we have, however, does not encourage this full personal reflection or discussion with loved ones, a component that the U.S. Catholic bishops recognize, noting in their pastoral message called The Blessing of Age, that you may worry about being unable to communicate your desires regarding these serious matters as life support systems, but advanced directives can help your loved ones know your wishes. To that end, Senate Bill 494 does two important things. It ensures a clear, concise process for appointment of a healthcare representative, and it provides a thoughtful framework for a more inclusive form that, in addition to a checklist of medical interventions, will promote and encourage these discussions and conversations about how an individual wishes to be treated and cared for when they become seriously ill. Catholic teaching recognizes that death is an inevitable part of life, but as best we can, it need not be a lonely or terrifying event. We believe from within our experiences in Catholic healthcare that an individual's healthcare preferences and desires and wishes are most likely to be carried out when they are captured in an advanced directive that is the finest and most effective tool that we can offer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sarah Kaufman, and I work for the Alzheimer's Association, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 494. Alzheimer's is a progressive and fatal brain disease that will affect an estimated 5.5 million Americans this year. And nearly one in every three seniors who dies each year has Alzheimer's disease or another dementia. And today we have an estimated 63,000 Oregonians age 65 and older living with Alzheimer's disease. A diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is life-changing, both for the individual and the people who love them. However, research has shown that taking full advantage of available treatments and care and support options can improve the quality of life that remains. This includes participating in decisions about living options, legal and financial matters, and end-of-life care decisions. An individual with Alzheimer's disease and their care partners have a choice about their treatments at the end of life. Discussing options and making decisions about end-of-life care should happen early in the disease process. The Alzheimer's Association endorses and encourages people with Alzheimer's disease to complete an advanced directive and to talk with their loved ones and their family members and their physicians about their medical choices. Making medical decisions about treatment remains the right of the person with dementia until they no longer have the capacity to make this decision. At that time, medical decisions are made by their legally defined surrogate. Senate Bill 494 will update the current advance directive form in a manner that will encourage Oregon families to have and document more valuable and important discussions about their healthcare values and their wishes. And engaging in these types of conversation early in the disease process is of the utmost importance for people with dementia to ensure that their wishes are known and that their values and beliefs will be carried out when they are no longer able to speak for themselves. Senate Bill 494 is a result of a multi-year stakeholder conversation where different and diverse viewpoints came together to create this bill. The intent is not to harm Oregonians, including people with dementia, but to encourage communication about values and treatment and to ensure clarity in an individual's wishes for end-of-life care. And it's important to keep in mind that a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease alone is not an indication of decision-making incapacity. A person with Alzheimer's disease may lack the capacity to drive or live independently in the community, but they still have the capacity to make sound decisions about where they want to live or the medical care they wish to receive. A person with dementia has a legal right to request treatments and the right to refuse medical treatments as well. And it's in crucial importance to respect the autonomy of individuals with dementia and appreciate that they have choices in end-of-life care. Millions of Americans have dementia or have Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. And as the size and proportion of the U.S. population aged 65 and older continues to increase, the number of Americans and Oregonians with Alzheimer's disease will grow. As people with late-stage Alzheimer's disease near end of life and are no longer able to make their own decisions, families and loved ones are going to have to make those choices on behalf of the person that they love. When advance directives are in place, family members and loved ones can take solace in knowing that they are respecting the person's values and wishes while maintaining his or her comfort and dignity. Supporting Senate Bill 494 is one way to ensure that more Oregonians, including individuals with Alzheimer's disease and dementia, will have a way to give guidance on the healthcare decisions they want made on their behalf. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
All right, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and call up the following panel: Hillary Newcomb, Jen Bartholomew, and I need to ask Kay Bridges. You came in late. Are you for or against?
You're talking to me?
If you're Ms. Bridges, I am.
Against for.
All right, thank you. I just want to make sure I put you in the right column. I just needed to make sure I had you in the right column so I knew how you're going to be testifying, so when to call you up.
Not
no,
yet.
Ma'am.
Okay,
and why don't y'all go ahead and get started?
Good morning.
Oh, the other thing, excuse me. Let's see. Hillary, you're going to start off.
Yes.
I know that you have handed in written testimony.
Correct.
So you do not need to read it into the record.
Correct.
It's part of the record. If you can just summarize, please.
Yes, Chair Przanski. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. Thank you for your time this morning and efforts here today. My name is Hillary Newcomb. I'm an attorney practicing exclusively in the area of estates and trusts. I'm also a member of the executive committee of the estate planning administrative section of the bar. We have participated, myself as well as other attorneys who are similar to my background and experience, in the work group for the past 2 years. And representatives in the elder law section were included among those attorneys. Our concerns have always been and remain client-based, as well as from a specifically legal and technical perspective. And that alone has been our concern and perspective. A large part of the attorneys that practice in my area of law, the elder law section of the bar, the estate planning attorneys, we focus on incapacity, end-of-life planning, and death. And that's the perspective we come from when we meet with our clients, talk with our clients, and draft the related estate planning documents, including the advance directive form. Our section members have expressed their concerns, as Dr. Woody English alluded to, with the extensive surveys that were conducted, and that reinforced our known concern in our legal community that the advance directive form was dated to be updated and made more current to clarify the ambiguities and just remain more of a living, breathing, current, and more useful document for our clients' benefit. So that has been the focus of the bar. That has been the focus of our perspective with the work group duration. We appreciated the opportunity to be on the work group and are satisfied with Senate Bill 494 and support that. Please let me know of any questions.
All right, thank you. And
John.
Chair presents.
Oh, got it.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. We are a statewide organization, part of the national organization with 500,000 members here in the state. You do have written testimony from us as well that was prepared by my boss, Jerry Cohen, who intended to be here today with his wife, Ruth Cohen. Ruth is a geriatric care manager and has worked with people making these decisions for many years. And Jerry actually started his career as an legal services director under the Older Americans Act, and so they have a lot more knowledge, but Ruth had some health issues and couldn't be here today, and he's making sure that he's with her. So their testimony is here on the record. I will just say a couple brief words, and then I also want to say something about the other bill that we have a open hearing on. Right. So what I want to say about Senate Bill 494 and why we support it, it goes back to basic principles that are already enshrined in state law for long-term care. In ORS 410, it specifically outlines the principles of independence, choice, and dignity. If you lose your independence, we want to make sure that your choice and dignity continue to be respected. An advance directive preserves those choices that you make before you lose your independence, and the dignity is that your choices will continue to be respected by the people, the healthcare representative you've named, as well as the other people in the decision-making process. So that is really the foundation of why we support this legislation. On Senate Bill 768, which would create a registry for advanced directives, we also would like to say that we support that bill as well. We understand that a fiscal on that might be problematic to it finally being passed, but making sure that an advance directive can be found when it's needed is critically important. The POLST task force has a registry, and we believe that advance directives should also be found as readily so that you can avoid these confusions. You know, make sure that an advance directive does no good if it's sitting in somebody's safe at home, and family members then start having arguments about what mom wanted. So we want to make sure that it can be found, especially if care is needed, these decisions are needed somewhere far away from a person's primary care physician who might actually have it on the record. So with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel, Gail Atterbury, I believe it's Bernice Jones. And I have Colm Willis. Is he back from?
Not yet.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and bring Kate Kelly up, please. And Bernice, I know that you also have given posted testimony and stuff, so we'd prefer you not trying to read stuff into the record since it's already in the record. If you can just give us the highlights and
Gail.
Points.
My name is Gail.
I may be looking at you. I'm just saying for Bernice. Just as I just told the other person that's given testimony with something that's already posted. We don't need you to read it in the record because it's already part of the record.
Right.
Gail, did you want to start off?
I'll start off. And Chair Prasansky, my name is Gail Atterbury. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Right to Life. and I'm pleased to be here today. There's been excellent testimony so far, some by legal attorneys. I will say right now that Oregon Right to Life has legal attorneys who have a very, very different perspective than what has been presented today. And should Cullum get back in time, Lord willing, we will hear from him. Our legal attorneys have the opinion that Senate Bill 494 will definitely impact the care of Alzheimer's and dementia patients. One of Oregon Right to Life's many objections to SB 494 is validated by the fact that we're actually having a hearing today and possible amendments, which I saw that were posted, and so those may or may not go in. Our objection, this objection, the main one that we're talking about right now, is that SB 494 takes the power of changing future advance directives out of the legislative process and gives the power of writing all future advance directives to an unaccountable committee appointed by the governor. A committee of numerous people has spent a minimum of 2 years drafting SB 494. The bill, unfortunately, has been drafted in such a dangerous manner that Alzheimer's and dementia patients are at risk of being starved and dehydrated to death. However, this hearing and amendments highlights the importance of the legislative process. That's why we have the legislature, and that is to craft bills with input from many sources with the hope that in the end, a bill which has taken into account diverse views is drafted to the best interest of all. And I would like to say right now, Oregon Right to Life is not opposed to advance directives. In fact, we encourage our members to be sure and fill them out. And we are not also opposed to changing it or tweaking or if it needs to be updated, which we've heard, we're not opposed to that. But we are opposed to having a separate, unaccountable, appointed committee do that. We think that it should continue to be done through the legislative process. SB 494 leaves the writing of future advance directives to an unaccountable committee. In spite of what we've heard today, the process by which this unaccountable committee reports to the chairman's, and it can be waived, which is nothing stops it from being waived. And this unaccountable committee can come up with a very deadly advance directive, as we have already seen in SB 494. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Who would like to go next?
I'll go next.
If you'll just give us your name, please.
My name is Kate Kelly, and Chair Brzezinski, Senators, I want to thank you for hearing my testimony here. I'm here to discuss the experience I have had watching someone die from dehydration and starvation. My mother, sorry, it's very difficult to speak of. My mother, Irene, was in a care facility. She had Alzheimer's. She was very childlike. She loved stuffed toys, chocolate, ice cream, treats like that. She was quite animated, as she had been before she had dementia. And she had a mild stroke and was attempting to speak, was attempting to indicate that she wanted water. And there had been a power of attorney, the relative with power of attorney had been convinced to sign comfort care only. And a young doctor who had never seen my mother before decided and stated, she'll be gone in 24 hours, morphine only, no food, no water. I stayed with my mother for 6 days and nights. I barely left the room for anything more than about 5 minutes for the entire 6 days and nights that it took her to die. On the first night, until very early in the morning, her mouth hung open, her tongue fluttered and rolled, her jaw quivered, she moaned, and she clasped my hand tightly. In the following days, she continuously moaned. I was told that's not moaning, that's just air escaping from her lungs. That's what the staff told me. Her eyes rolled back and forth under her lids. They were almost closed. I was there to able to give her, with a small piece of gauze, dampness on her lips. Her lips clamped so tightly on the gauze that I would sometimes have to pull it from her mouth. I was told that's just reflex, that she's not in pain. Her mouth did open, other than clamping for the water. And there were blisters and ulcerations that developed after the second day in her mouth. On one occasion, the staff was late with the morphine. My mother's face contorted and twisted, and agonized moans came from her. One caregiver on the fourth day noted that my mother was not even mottling, which the hands and feet darken because the blood is being withdrawn to sustain the major organs. That caregiver was hustled out of the room quickly by other staff. My mother clasped my hand until the fifth day, when she weakened and her hand was not nearly as tight. Her breathing was labored and uneven throughout the process of dying, becoming worse and worse constantly. Her weight was down to about 60 pounds. She was a small woman, about 5 feet tall. She was on another occasion, the staff asked me to leave, and I said I had been there. I had seen them turn her and seen her tiny body. Why did they want me to leave? And they said, we have to give her a suppository. When I asked what for, I was told for anxiety. I later discovered this was to prevent convulsions. My mother, Irene, was not dying. She had a mild stroke. The decision was made that she would die.
Ms. Kelly, did your mother have an advance directive?
No, she did not have an advance directive. The decision was made by the person with power of attorney.
I appreciate that. The bill that we have, the two bills that we have before us, are dealing with advance directives.
I understand.
So I need you to stay germane to the topic of the two bills, please.
Chair Przanski, the reason that we feel that she's germane to the topic is that we are strongly convinced that this bill allows the starvation and dehydration of patients.
So, Ms. Atterbury, can you please show us in the bill where it actually would provide for the starvation or keeping someone from being hydrated? We've had testimony, and what the current law currently is, mm-hmm. as for comfort mm-hmm. food and water. And so if you can please...
Yes, that would be coming up with our attorney.
So then you've read the bill,
yes,
I'm assuming.
Yes,
you've
I
read
have.
The dash two amendments. Could you just
please
point out to the committee where in the bill it says that someone can be starved or denied water?
What we firmly believe is that with this new bill, the healthcare representative will have the power to make the decision that the
where do you see that within the bill that would give the authority to that individual to make?
We believe that the power of attorney has been taken away, has been scrubbed from the bill. From the current law. And with the current law, the power of attorney could only do what is what the instructions are given by the patient. With the power of attorney gone and the healthcare representative wording being in its place, healthcare representative is a little ambiguous term, and we feel very strongly that this healthcare representative will have the ability to make decisions that are beyond what perhaps has actually written down in the healthcare or in the advance directive. I need my attorney up here. I'm not an attorney.
Well, Ms. Atterbury, you're making statements as to that. I know that you've read the bill. I know that you're very familiar with this process. So if you can show us or tell us where in the bill you think that it actually allows for the healthcare representative to deviate from the instructions that have been given to them by the individual that has signed the advance directive, We'd like to know that.
And it goes back to the fact that the power of attorney has been taken out of the bill and in its place, healthcare representative. It's unclear to our attorneys what healthcare representative the powers actually are.
All right. Then we'll hopefully your attorney gets back and we'll be able to go over
yes,
that.
I hope that he does because he can speak more legally than I can. But that is why that we believe that her testimony is germane.
All right. I'm ruling at this point, based on what I'm hearing, that it's not germane. And so I understand, I'm very, very sorry, Ms. Kelly, that your mother apparently went through this process that you just have been describing to us. I'm not sure. It's not germane for me to be asking. I hope that you've reached out and had legal assistance as to how the conduct of that institution, the facility, operated, because it seems to me that they did not follow the law as required by the state.
Thank you, Chairperson.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kelly, for coming forward and giving us that story.
Thank you.
Bernice?
Chair, I'm sorry, I'm a little upset. Chair, how do you pronounce your name?
Brzezinski.
Brzezinski, thank you.
Uh-huh.
And members of the, I'm sorry, I'm really choked up. And members of the, Judicial Committee. I will make this as brief, thank you. I'll make this as brief as I can. I'm Mrs. Bernice Jones, and I represent Life Guardian Foundation. We're a pro-life organization that our efforts are to protect and preserve all human life. And I am here today in hopes to represent the most vulnerable and innocent in Oregon. Our organization opposes Senate Bill 494. Every person and every healthcare representative must have the option to protect and preserve life. The form of an advance directive is provided to designate a healthcare representative for the patient. If the patient's representative is not available, if the healthcare representative believes that life-sustaining medical therapy is not helpful, it can be stopped and not used. An advance directive should designate all treatment and care to protect and preserve life. If organs are taken, it must be after death, not near death, and the word imminent death, because this obviously means the person is alive. And if any of you have any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? I do have one question for you, Bernice.
Yes.
I understand your organization believes in the sanctity of life. Does the organization take the position that an individual who is competent, who does want to have decisions to how their final days or times of their life will be spent, does your organization reject that ability for an individual to be able to independently make those decisions if they're competent to make those decisions?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No, we encourage that.
All right, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be... Yeah, I know that. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to bring Kay Bridges and Jane. I'm sorry, you're going to have to help me with your last name. Marcia.
Marciana.
Why don't you please come forward?
Marciana.
And you can come forward. And then it looks like Dwayne Shaw. Would you like to go ahead and start it?
Chair Pokrowski and committee. First of all, I'd like to say I'm 80.
I need your name, please.
Kay Bridges.
Kay
Sorry
Bridges.
About that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bridges.
I'm 80, and this bill is probably rather emotional for me. And I would say, how many of you stood by your dying parent or family member?
Multiple times.
And I would rather have my daughter make decisions for me than any healthcare professional, and I think 494 may be leaving a bit of an opening for some changes in that. There's a lot of confusion, and I don't envy you guys at all. But I think that what's in place may be what should stay there.
Ms. Bridges, have you had a chance
My floral shop,
Ms. Bridges, have you had a chance to read the bill and look at the farms?
I have gone through it 20-some pages, whatever. Yeah. And seeing how many things it changes in the laws.
And did you see
that? I used to do ORS revisions for a title company, so it was my job to go and read the bills and put them in place.
When you read through the bill, did you see where the individual who's entering into the advance directive has the choice to choose who would be their representative?
I believe so, yes.
And that they had...
It first came out, and I've heard so much since then, and I've heard so much testimony now.
I know there's been a lot of misinformation that has been put out into the...
I agree.
And so when you look at the bill on the farm, it actually calls for the individual to choose who will make those decisions for them. That will be their primary representative. Then the individual has the option of having a first alternative and a second alternative. So I just want to make certain that you understand.
But as they have also said, there are committees that can change it in the future.
No, no.
May I just share my experience and you take it and put it in context with your knowledge?
Well, there's no committees that make a decision as to an individual person's advanced directive.
The committee
itself only deals with the farm that is brought before the committee or to the legislature, and they have to meet at least once every 4 years. So the committee has nothing to do with an individual advance directive that has been executed, entered into by an individual. So that's part of the misinformation that unfortunately has been distributed out on this bill. So I'd like for you to stay germane to what we have as compared to what may be and what is, in fact, misleading to many people. It's very unfortunate that misinformation has been given out to so many people.
May I share my experience with my parents?
In what context, in the sense of, did they have advanced directives that weren't followed?
It's mostly about the care and families who do not understand and try to dispute the decision that a person has made.
Okay.
Advanced directive.
Right.
So, which I don't think this bill clarifies.
So if you could speak as to where you think the bill does not clarify the individual entering into an advanced directive isn't clear as to what their wishes are, because it sounds to me what you're referring to is a difference of opinion between family members as to what should or shouldn't happen as compared to someone entering into an advanced directive. And we're not here to try to take up the family issue as to who gets to make the decision. This bill deals with having an individual who is competent to enter into a decision that they would like to have a directive on their life and health care and how they would like to have it played for their benefit. While they are competent, they make that decision, and that way when they are not competent, there is the guidance and the instructions of how this does go forward based, and they have the individuals that they have chosen to be their primary first alternate or second alternate healthcare representative, not a committee.
So a healthcare representative would make the decision?
The person, and you say in your situation, Ms. Bridges, if you entered into an advanced directive today, you would basically would be choosing who would be making those decisions under this bill as to your daughter would be your primary, and then you'd make a decision whether or not you would have anyone else as a first alternative or a second alternative.
Well, I have made the decision that my daughter will make the decisions.
Okay.
in my advance directive.
That's great.
My parents didn't have one.
And that's why I wanted to ask about that, because the story that you want to share to us is not germane to the bill that we have before us. Our bill that's before us is dealing with advance directives and the form that is being proposed and the procedure that will be used for updating the form in the future if it passes, if this bill passes.
And
that's what it
deals can be
with.
Updated in any manner, apparently.
If you're asking about the general form, it has a procedure that they have to go through. That's called out in the bill as to how that is done and how the decisions are made with the majority vote of the committee, and then a requirement that it comes to the four committees in the legislature for their potential review. If you're talking about someone changing their advance directives, that's called out by law as to you as the individual making the advance directive having the authority to change and modify your advance directive or cancel your advance directive at any time.
So you have made the decision that my personal experience is not pertinent to the bill?
What I'm saying is, based on what you said that you want to discuss about the death of your parents that did not have advance directives, I do not see what is germane to that, to the bills that we have before us.
Well, I have seen people and delivered flowers to people every Monday who have been disrespected. That isn't in this testimony that I gave.
Right. But I don't see the germaneness of you giving experiences that you've seen about people that you deliver flowers to this bill. So I'm going to need you to either tell us stuff that's germane to the bill, or I'm going to ask the next person to speak.
And you don't feel mine is, but you didn't read it.
Based on what you've said that you're wanting to talk about, it's not germane to Senate Bill 494.
It's a very interesting conversation.
Yes. Who would like to go next?
My doctor friend even told me to stay away from doctors and hospitals and I'd be fine. This is a very emotional testimony as I've heard here. And I've heard the Right to Life people say that there are confusions in the bill. The emotional issues that we face when we have to deal with parents who are dying and those decisions seem to me to be pertinent to the bill and to your decision in your evaluation and understanding of the things that the gentleman here has explained.
So, Ms. Bridges,
seems to me there is more confusion than clarification, actually.
Ms. Bridges, you're continuing to talk about issues that I deem not to be germane to the bill, as to now you're talking about competency of individuals. That is something that has a completely different body of law that has dictation as to how a person needs to determine whether they're competent or not competent. This bill does not determine or establish what is competency. It uses what is current law as to determining that, as to whether someone has the ability to enter into an advanced directive. So at this point, I'm going to ask someone who else wants to give testimony, because based on what you've told me, you want to give us emotional testimony as to your experiences. I'm very sorry that you've had these experiences of watching individuals pass on, but that's not the basis for this bill. So, Jane, would you like to give your testimony on Senate Bill 494?
Yes, Chairman Prozanski and members of your committee. My name is Jane Marchantis, and I'm a lifelong resident of Portland, Oregon. I'm opposed to SB 494 and 239. I realize that 239 is not being heard right now, but I wanted to send, I wanted to send a copy when 239 was being heard, and it was not distributed, even though beforehand they said it would be. And I'll read an analysis of SB 494. Prepared by Mr. Walter Weber, Senior Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice in Washington, D.C. I have also included his analysis of the unamended and amended versions of 239. He said,
Jane,
yes?
Regarding Senate Bill 239, that's not currently before the committee.
I know, I realize that. But when I sent,
we have the bill in our committee, but it's not here today. So I need you to limit your testimony to the bill that we have. We can't take testimony on a bill that's not been properly noticed for the general public.
But sir, the last time I wanted to send something in writing, and they said that they would distribute it to members of the committee, and then they did not do it. So they told me when I came to the Judiciary Committee, I could mention that.
Okay,
I'm not going to discuss it, but I've got something here.
And Jane, I appreciate you telling us that there's some mistake that was made at a different committee. When and if we take up Senate Bill 239, you'll have an opportunity to give testimony live. If you want to submit written testimony on Senate Bill 239,
you can submit it to us, and we will. I'm here for 494, actually.
That's why I'm trying to get you to testify for. So if you'll give us your testimony, limiting it to Senate Bill 494 or 768. That's the two bills that we have before us right now.
So I'm allowed to testify for 494, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Oregon Right to Life has already done. This is Walter Weber from the American Center for Law and Justice.
Is this testimony that you've submitted in writing to the committee?
Yes.
All right. Since it's been posted, we don't need you to read the testimony into the record. It's part of the record. If you want to make comment regarding what he has said as compared to going verbatim, we'd appreciate that as to what you'd like to bring forward.
Well, I can't read it.
We have, if you've posted it, we have the ability and we will read the testimony. What we're trying to do is I'm trying to get everyone that wants to testify that's here today an opportunity to do that, or they're going to have to potentially come back and they may be denied being able to give testimony because they may not be able to come back the next time.
Because I have given many times testimony since 1986. And I was always permitted to read it.
All right. The chair would ask you to summarize the testimony. If it's already been posted, we have it here. Everyone will read it. But we're trying to get other people involved that are here to be able to give their testimony as well.
It's very short.
Pardon? Did somebody say something?
Go ahead.
Yes, well, I think that this whole thing is awful, but yeah, my sister died because it was 11 years ago, and she was in a nursing home, and she did not sign any formal thing. But she did sign something that she wanted me to make decisions. She was put on the death watch the minute she was in there. They said, you should let your sister die. I said, my sister is not terminal. They said, very soon she will be. They tried all kinds of tricks. I was there 24 hours a day. They did not like it. And they finally, twice, ejected me. The police ejected me.
Yeah. Jane? I need you. It sounds like you're not going to give us testimony regarding the specifics of the bill, which is Senate Bill 494 or Senate Bill 768. The story that you want to share to us is not germane to what we have before us. And so unless you have testimony regarding the bill that's before us, I'm going to move on to the next individual.
Now, this whole thing, as my health provider recommends. The health provider in that nursing home recommended death for her. And she was getting treatments. She was getting radiation treatments and she was responding. They said she died from cancer, which was not true. I had an autopsy done. She did not die from cancer. She died from an overdose of blood thinner. And this was their...
Jane.
They told me to leave.
Jane.
And I was not allowed to stay with her. Now, your health care provider...
Jane, I'm ruling that your testimony now into the specifics of your loved one's death is not part of this, what's before us on Senate Bill 494.
It is, because it says, as my health care provider recommends.
And that's
the health care provider recommended death.
Thank you. Dwayne?
You may rule me out of order. My name is Dwayne Shaw.
Yes, sir.
You're looking at a person that has watched my parents and my wife die because of lack of food and water. I was upset and still am. My wife in particular may have had an advance directive, but I can tell you this, if she had known that they were going to starve her to death, she'd have never signed it. That's a given. Now, it was interesting, when she was taken to the hospital, they kept her in emergency all day long. Finally gave her a room at 10 o'clock that night. The next day she was in ICU. And the doctor said, well, the blood work doesn't look good. And you know, she'll be in, because of a broken hip, she will be in about 8 weeks in rehabilitation. The next thing, I went home that night. The next day I couldn't find her, and she was in palliative care. No food, no water. And myself and our youngsters were with her 24 hours a day, and we know that she got no food, no water. In fact, they asked the staff, why can't you at least relent so we can talk to her and do something? And the answer was no. And but interesting enough, on a Saturday evening, after being told that she would choke if they gave her anything, they gave her a morphine pill. And my daughter picked up on that, my daughter Joyce, and said, you said she can't swallow anything. Why'd you give her a pill? And with that, she went to the supervisor and complained about it. Shortly thereafter, the wife became a little agitated. The kids picked up on it. They gave her a cloth, and she literally chomped that thing to get water. And if you've ever watched somebody die like that, it is not a pleasant experience. And I've watched this three times. Now, you can argue the technicalities of the bill, but I've watched this in three different hospitals. And what I'm trying to say is, we're trying to play God sometimes, and we're human beings. And sometimes people make decisions. Now, my wife could handle pain better than anybody I've ever known. She was a jewel. She never complained. And to watch that happen, I sometimes get emotional. I'm fighting it right now. But anyway, that is the sum and substance of what I have to say, that this has happened in more than one hospital, and she could have recovered, in my judgment, if given time. Broken bones do mend, and she was never given that chance.
All right. Well, thank you for coming forward and for all three of you wanting to tell your personal stories. I'm very sorry as to the life experiences that you've had on this. So at this point, I need to stop the hearing. At this point, I need...
My sister was deprived of food and water for 4 days.
They don't care, Jane. Come on.
I got no help.
At this point, we need to conclude the hearing for today because we're already over time. I need to let committee members out. So at this point, I have two individuals that are on the witness list, Combe Willis and Roger Martin, that have signed up to give testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who did not sign up who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 494 or Senate Bill 768? All right, I'm not seeing anyone come forward or raise their hand. So those two individuals will be invited back to give their testimony. We have scheduled this, and we will do this first thing immediately on Monday morning. We will be posting this for an 8 o'clock hearing, for those two individuals to be able to give their testimony. So, colleagues, we will need to make an adjustment since we weren't able to get everyone through and have that done. So for Combe and for Roger, if you will be back here on Monday morning at 8 o'clock, we'll take your testimony. With that, we're adjourned for the day.
Thanks for consent.
Adjourned for the day.